There are fewer than 30 men in the world qualified to drive Formula One. A mere half dozen, perhaps, to win. At this moment, I'm inclined to think you're not one of them.
No, you want to.
Keep up the good work, and there you have it. There you go. With the qualifying.
Welcome to F1Weekly.com. My name is Clark Rogers. I'm the host of the program. I'll be joined by Nasser Hamid, my co-host. This is podcast number 1056, August 12th, 2024. Nasser.
Thank you, sir. I say, what will you do for a Klondike bar and $100 million? That is the question from a billionaire to a millionaire. The answer may deliver a max performance. And Department of Justice is knock, knock, knocking on heaven's door. We shall explain gladly. Back to you, sir.
Thank you, Nasser. On today's program, Lee Diffie, leaving IndyCar for Le NASCAR. Alex Palou to Audi F1? What about Bottas? Michael Schumacher's 2002 Ferrari F2001B up for sale. We're talking about one of the approximately 12 world championship winning Ferraris. One of only 30 Ferrari Formula One chassis with a Michael Schumacher victory. This is phenomenal stuff going out there, folks, so somebody's going to have a lot of fun. Grand Prix of Rwanda in beautiful downtown Kigali is brilliant. And the host has a new segment called the Walter Cronkite Corner. And this week's interviews, ladies and gentlemen, we've got Scott Mitchell, Lawrence Barreto, and Chase Carey. And yes, indeed, ladies and gentlemen, once again, I do have to remind everyone that yes, we do need your contributions to keep this program on the air. So please click on the Support F1 Weekly tab. You know, you want to. NAS, not much racing, a lot of Olympics, and interesting stuff in Richmond for some people. How you doing?
I'm doing very good, sir. Thank you. I hope all is well on the left coast. But here we go again. The 2024 season keeps on giving one surprise after another. The latest hot rumor is, and it's getting hotter day by day, that Adrian Newey has decided to join Aston Martin after John Elkann at Ferrari played a Hall & Oates tune to Newey and his soft-spoken manager, Mr. Eddie Jordan. Can't go for that, no can do, on their demand for $25 million per year. And you know, I have referred to this ItaliaRacing.net website, and they are very good, and they do put a lot of good information out there. They are very critical of John Elkann of letting this wonderful opportunity slip by. Now, this amount, $25 million per year, as we all know, is Tim Horton's tater tots for Mr. Stroll. If he can pay Adrian $25 million, imagine how big the check will be for Max. I have a feeling in the windmills of yours, the boss's mind, there is massive turbulence and a desire to his son, to see his son say happy trails to Christian Horner and whoever is left in Milton Keynes in or at the end of 2025. If this happens, who will be odd man out at Aston Martin? A driver in his 40s who has not won a race in over a decade? Or a young whippersnapper who, according to the most credible person in the paddock, who as we all know is Pedro de la Rosa, is about to unleash his talents after... How many years has Lance been in Formula One now, sir? 6 or 7 years already?
I believe it's 7 years, sir.
Wow. So he's getting that 7-year itch to perform. So that's very comforting to know, especially if you are Fernando Alonso. Now, I am thinking Maybe there is more to the story, because even Toto Wolff can find out from Wikipedia, the whippersnapper and team owner share the same nationality and last name. In the final analysis, I expect a text message coming from Pedro de la Rosa saying, "Nando, blood is thicker than gazpacho." What say you, amigo?
Yes, the final curtain has arrived. Nasser, I mean, you know, and I've read some articles about, let's just call them journeyman race car drivers. I mean, do we need term limits, Nasser, to get the young people into the flow of things? Because, yeah, listen, nobody likes Fernando more than I do. I am the top kahuna in his fandom. But there are other people trying to get into Formula One, and even Mark Martin eventually threw in the towel.
But, you know, he was able to go, you said Mark Martin, right?
Correct.
Yeah, he was able to go so long because he had, you know, who his sponsor was.
Of course.
Thank you. So maybe Alonso needs to contact people at Cialis, get this thing going a few more years.
Perfect for Rwanda.
Yes. Now, you're a music man. You remember the song, "I Hear You Knocking, But You Can't Come In." Probably one of your favorites.
I hear you knocking, but you can't come in. Bum, 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 bum.
There you go. Well, Liberty, your favorite corporation, has confirmed DOJ, also known as Department of Justice of the wonderful United States of America, has come knocking on their door. Just like in the movie My Cousin Vinny, DOJ is accusing Liberty Media of aiding and abetting in not allowing Michael Andretti back into Formula One, this time as a team owner, and they have some questions. Well, I just hope when DOJ shows up for a meeting in the morning with Mr. Greg Maffei in his executive suite, they bring some sour cream donuts and a Glenn Fry CD featuring "The Heat Is On." Now, this is just me thinking. Just me as a race fan, nothing more, nothing less. The end game, as I see it, will be a typical corporate face-saving SOP. Liberty Media will allow Michael and his team to enter Formula One without admitting any guilt or wrongdoing. Now, if you recall, when we had a chat with Mario Andretti a few months ago, the first thing he said, because I asked him about this DOJ getting involved, and first thing he says, "I want to make very clear that I or we did not approach DOJ or the U.S. Congress asked him to come and explain what is going on." And what does Mr. Judge Wapner of podcasting, which is you, has to say on this Department of Justice getting serious like Jane?
Well, Liberty has, you know, their hands in a lot of entertaining industries. Ticketmaster, Live Nation. So they've been under the DOJ microscope for some time. This just pushed them over because, let's face it, Mario Andretti and the members of Congress, most of them, are about the same age. So these people remember Mario, and Mario's going to get a lot of support from these guys. So it's going to be interesting, but you're right. Eventually, Michael will be able to get the old fur coats out of the closet, get back on the Concorde, and start driving again in Formula One.
And if you look at people who are backing his IndyCar team and his IndyCar project, there's a company called Group 1001. These people are, let's just put it this way, they don't stop at 7-Eleven for coffee or Waffle House for breakfast in the morning. So, and when you have money, money is power, you have contacts, you have influence, and when the Department of Justice tree starts shaking, then, you know, cats and rats are running around saying, yes, sir, because that's a very powerful... Actually, I was thinking, you know, this antitrust law is based on Sherman Act. Now, we are in modern times. I think it should be now called the Caterpillar Act, because if you don't comply with their rules and regulations, they will bulldoze you. Mr. Bill Gates, long time ago, also heard from Department of Justice, and recently Google was also in the news. So this is a very powerful arm of the U.S. government. You know, to deny Michael Andretti on the ground that they don't bring any value and they will not be competitive in first year. Gee, how competitive is Alpine, Kick Sauber, Haas? So I don't think they have a good argument. And now that they are meeting, they have met their match now. And let's see how that goes. And I would like to see this thing resolved out of court, you know, peacefully, so we don't have bad blood or mud on our beloved sport. So we'll keep an eye on what's happening. Now we come to your favorite team, of course. Next on the agenda, Alpine powered by Mercedes. Oh, that sounds so beautiful. That's called adding value. That's like Mercedes running with the Honda engine. The question is, will it be driven by Mick or Mick's son? Alpine has become Lusitania of the grid, sinking slowly. Even the German power plant may not be able to save it. Pierre Gasly is waiting to hear who will be his teammate next season. According to JV, no team is jumping to hire Mick Schumacher, and if they do, it will only be for his last name. And one has to agree with JV on this one. So the favorite now is Mick Doohan's son, Jack. He has been an Alpine junior for a few years, and they need to provide him a seat in 2025 pronto, or he will do a Piastri Twitter on them. You know, I had a brief chat with Jack Doohan at Miami, and he was willing to do an interview, but he said you have to go through the team PR, and you know how that is, especially on a Sunday. So who would you like to see, not who will they will hire, but who would you like to see at Alpine?
Mick Schumacher. You know, why not? It's not like they're going to do anything exciting. Throw the kid in there, give him another season. Why can't we be loving people?
There you go. Now, here is the real escargot in the deal. With Oliver Oakes appointed as team principal with the full blessing of Briatore and Renault Group CEO Luca Di Meo, he may have his own agenda for the second seat. And this gets very interesting. The standout rookie in Formula 2 is Paul Aron from Estonia, who used to be in the Mercedes Junior program, and he's still very young. He drives for High Tech. And who owns High Tech team? Survey says Oliver Oakes. Then there is Lance Stroll of Siberia by the name of Nikita Mazepin. Apparently, a major cash investment was made in High Tech from Lawrence Stroll of, listen to this, you're concerned about Kigali, this gentleman is from Kazakhstan. This man apparently has no interest in motor racing, and according to published reports, he may be front man for Dmitry Mazepin. Let's see how this charade is played out in the coming days and weeks. All I can say, it will be a shame if Nikita is back in Formula 1. No stinky feeling against him or his Papito's fertilizer company, Uralkali, but please, not at the expense of Jack Doohan. And sir, now we come to Don't Cry For Me, Argentina. Juncos Hollinger Racing, part owned by the owner, who is from Argentina, Ricardo Juncos, and we have interviewed him a couple of times in the recent past. He has released his homeboy, Agustin Canapino, from his contract. In the past two seasons, every time Canapino made contact with another driver, including his ex-teammate Callum Ilott, there were nasty comments and death threats from some of Canapino's supporters. And instead of condemning such behavior, his attitude was, this is common behavior among Argentine sports fans and should not be taken seriously. I think he did not realize Laguna Seca, Mid-Ohio, and Elkhart Lake were tracks in the United States of America, not Republica Argentina. So that's the story on that. And I have to say, you know, maybe Agustin will put it down to live and learn. He was very successful in Argentine 10 tops, but I will be very surprised if another team picks him up to continue him in IndyCar racing, because there are a lot of F1 rejects who are coming here. Some of them have very, well, some of them have daddies who have very deep pockets, so I don't think it's looking good for him. Another driver who has been released by his team is Alexander Rossi from the Arrows McLaren team, which we already know. But we will keep an eye on his new deal. He was one of the first drivers we ever interviewed. Do you remember talking to him many, many moons ago?
Absolutely. We had to keep soft drinks around for these young children.
Okay, sir. Shall we bring in Lawrence Barreto now?
Yes, he's got a lot to say. You know what? That's a great interview, Nasser. Bring him in.
Yes, Lawrence Barreto, sir, used to be an editor for Autosport magazine. obviously very knowledgeable, and I've been reading Autosport from the very early 70s, even before I got hooked on Formula One. We're talking 70, 71. And he worked there, he was editor, and now he works for F1 TV. And if you ever watch on F1 TV, they do a pre-race show. So he's very knowledgeable. And so let's welcome Mr. Lawrence Barreto to the Palatial Studios.
Okay, folks, I'm here with Lawrence Barreto. Lawrence, good to meet you again. How are you today?
I'm really good, thank you. Thanks. Nice to meet you properly.
Major upheaval in Formula One going on. First, Lewis going to Ferrari. Was that a surprise? And is it good for him? What say you?
I don't think it was a surprise that he went to Ferrari, because I think Ferrari had been chasing him for a long time. But I think the timing of the decision or the announcement was a surprise. I think it's a great opportunity for Lewis to go and finish his career very strongly towards the end, to go for that eighth title. I think to win it with Ferrari would be something pretty special. I think it's great for Ferrari because they get a big name kind of in that seat, and then they've got that super lineup with Charles Leclerc and Lewis Hamilton. So yeah, I think all round, including for Formula One, it's a great idea.
Speaking of eighth title, which I would love to see him get, the question is, will he get title number 8 in a red car before his buddy Alonso gets title number 3 in a green car?
That is a very good question. I imagine, just based on the current trends, if either of them were to win the title, based on current performance, you would have thought the Ferrari is probably in better shape to win a title before the Aston Martin. But then the Aston Martin is improving dramatically, quickly. I think Fernando, to start with, probably just wants to get that 33rd win under his belt, and then he'll start thinking about another title.
Now, Lewis and Charles Leclerc at Ferrari, will it be like Senna and Prost, or Alonso and Hamilton at McLaren 2007? What we call cage rattling.
Yeah, I honestly don't think that Charles and Lewis will fall out, or there's the potential for them to fall out in the way that Fernando and Lewis did at McLaren. But I do think it is a very intriguing lineup, because they're two very big personalities. Charles has obviously been in the Ferrari family for a long time. Lewis is coming in with all of these accolades. So I think there is the potential for some fireworks. But at the minute, in the early days, I think they're going to get on very well, actually, because at the moment, they've just got to take the team to the front of the grid. Until they get there, then I think everything will be pretty sweet.
Firework at Red Bull is out of control. Adrian Newey leaving. Did that come as a surprise, and where do you think he's headed?
I think it came as a surprise, the timing of it, again, similar to the Lewis and Ferrari announcement. I think that Adrian's been at Red Bull for a long time. I think it makes sense that at some point you want to try a different project. And he's 65 years old, so he's probably got one massive project left in him. Ferrari, to win with them, he said many times before that he would like to work with Lewis. He said many times before he'd like to work with Ferrari. So I'm not surprised that he is exploring other options. You know, Aston Martin understood to have offered him a deal. Lots of teams, including Williams, have talked to him as well. So I think there's a big chase for him on, and he's kind of got all the options available to him.
Now, in 2025, he'll be gone, and Honda will be saying sayonara to Red Bull. Do you think we will see Max at Red Bull in 2026?
At the moment, I think Max is pondering what he wants to do. He's obviously got this contract until the end of 2028. I think he's trying to weigh up whether or not he wants to stay. He wants a really nice environment to work in. He wants to believe the people that work there. And at the minute, I think he honestly hasn't made up his mind. I think that's the truth. Will he be there in 2026? I think we're going to have to wait and see.
Okay, we have three races in the United States. Yeah. Would you like to see a fourth? And where?
I think four races on a calendar would be too many, I think, in one country. I think three is the perfect number. I think there is a massive audience in America, and I think it's great that we go to three different places, spread across three very different states. So I think that's good. To have a fourth might be a little bit too much, especially when there are so many other countries lining up to get a Grand Prix on the calendar.
Now, young English driver Ollie Bearman made a fantastic debut in Saudi Arabia. How do you think he will do against Kimi Antonelli if both are racing in Formula One next year?
It all depends on the package, doesn't it, really? I think that if Ollie, depending on where Ollie ends up, I think he did such a good job at Ferrari. I think he proved, not only to himself, but to Ferrari and the rest of Formula One, that he has got the talent to succeed here. I think it also proved to Toto Wolff that Kimi Antonelli could step up, because if Ollie could do that kind of job, I think there was the belief that Kimi can do the same job as well. So I think their rivalry will just depend on the cars that they're in and the relative performance, because obviously if one team is better than the other, they won't be racing each other.
Logan Sargeant is the only American driver in Formula One. Do you think he will survive the rest of the season?
at the minute, it seems like Williams are giving him every chance to prove that he deserves to stay in that seat. Will he stay until the end of the year? God, you're going to have to ask James Sowles that.
Now, Formula 2 is the official Formula feeder series to Formula 1. What can be done to help people who win Formula 2 championship to get into Formula 1? Because what I see, if you win in your first year, you're in. But if you're doing second or third year, you're on slippery slope. Can Formula 1 do anything?
Well, I think at the minute, Formula 1 is in a spot where you've got the 20 best drivers on the grid. So there aren't always going to be that many openings from one year to another. So I think that it isn't really a case of having to do more about it. It's just the drivers coming through have to prove head above heels that they deserve to get a spot in Formula 1. Like, we're already talking about the fact that Kimi Antonelli, Oliver Behrman could step up next year, and the championship's only 3 rounds old. So I think that shows that if the talent is there, there is the potential for them to step up.
I'm sure you heard the US Congress is looking into why Mario Andretti and Michael Andretti's team was not allowed. Do you think it will affect on the decision made by Formula 1?
I don't really have a comment on that, to be honest.
You want to be PC?
I just don't really have a view on it. Like, the situation has been going on for a long time now. I think it's very clear that Andretti are keen to enter Formula 1. I think Formula 1 were very clear when they said that they would welcome GM and Andretti in 2027, I think it was, or 2028, I can't remember the dates. So I think there is willing from both sides. Just for whatever reason, they haven't reached an agreement at the minute.
Who will be Nico Hülkenberg's teammate in 2026 at Audi?
If I had a crystal ball, I think it's clear that Audi have a favourite in mind. I think they are very keen to have Carlos Sainz in that seat. Whether or not he will accept that will depend on the opportunities elsewhere on the grid. Obviously, at the minute, there are seats available at Red Bull. There are seats available at Mercedes. So we'll just have to wait and see. I think until those are filled, before Sainz will decide what he's going to do about Audi.
You've been following this for a while, and I've been enjoying your work for a long time. First question I have for you, in the time you've been following Formula 1, if you were team owners and you could pick two drivers at their peak, who would be those two drivers?
That's a very good question. I think I would always put Michael Schumacher in first and foremost, because I think not only what he could deliver in terms of pure speed on track, but it was what he did behind the scenes, how he got a team working together, how he pushed all of the boundaries from the level of fitness to the way that the relationships were, to the communication, to the quality of the facility. I think he was just the ultimate team player, so I think I'd put Michael in that car. The second one is harder, because I think then I would want to go with someone maybe a bit more likes to drive at the seat, by the seat of the pants, so maybe something like a Kimi Raikkonen, just because I think Kimi Raikkonen at his peak was so exciting to watch. He was such a great personality to have in the sport, and I think those two actually together would be a great partnership, and to have those two in the same team, see who would be better, would be a pretty cool thing to see.
Yeah, one serious and one I could care less. Yeah. That's a great combo. Finally, I greatly appreciate your time. Can you tell us a little bit about yourself, how you got interested in racing and how you came through the system?
Yeah, of course. So my dad was really interested in Formula 1 when I was younger, so we watched it on telly a lot. The first Grand Prix I watched was the 94 Australian Grand Prix, obviously when Damon Hill and Michael Schumacher crashed. And I just was fascinated by racing, so he took me to a lot of local racing, British saloon car racing, that kind of thing. And then I decided pretty early on I wanted to be a journalist. I wanted to work in Formula 1, so I just kind of tried to make the pathway as clear as I could to that. I did a journalism degree at Bournemouth University, and then managed to get a job at a sport magazine where I said I wanted to do the Formula 1 writing. Everyone else wanted to do football, cricket, rugby. Had the opportunities there, managed to interview Lewis within my first year, Jensen, Valentino Rossi, Michael Schumacher, and it kind of just led from there. I kind of ended up working at Autosport, which is obviously a massive name in motorsport publishing in the world. Worked for the BBC, and that was always a dream of mine, and got to do a bit of Formula 1 there as well. And then I had the opportunity to come to Formula 1, the commercial rights holder, at a time when they were looking to build their digital product. And that was the opportunity for me to move from writing into TV, into interviewing, into getting more, you know, kind of stories out of the drivers. And that's really what I wanted to do. I want to go and tell the stories. I like people. And I wanted to do a job that didn't really feel like a job.
No, you're doing a great job, and I enjoy your work very much. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much.
Lawrence, thanks for joining F1Weekly.com. Nasser?
Okay, sir. Now we're going to continue with motorsports mantra and your favorite race that is coming up soon, hopefully. Royalami to Kigali. Welcome to the new destination city. This is absolutely beyond amazing. Formula One is holding talks to stage a Grand Prix in Africa, not at Kyalami or oil-rich scam capital of the world, Nigeria or Angola, where there is a lot of oil in a place called Cabinda, but Rwanda. Let's take a quick look at this country. Nothing against this nation or people, just the facts, ma'am. Check this out. GDP per capita in Rwanda is US$994 for the year 2023, last year. So that's $994, just under $1,000. Just as a comparison, GDP per capita of Singapore is US$65,422. But wait, there's more. About 40% of Rwanda's population lives below poverty line. And according to Formula One people, they have the highest rate of productivity and GDP in Africa. And this country, I cannot believe, has 30 million plus to pay for an F1 race every year, which is a minimum 5-year contract. And if Bernie's rule is still there, automatic 5% increase every year. This can only happen from the mind of 1% of the 100% corrupt government officials. Based on facts on the ground, Kigali is more of a destitute city than a destination city. And I think what they are doing, Mr. Rogers, people in power, this is what I call financial genocide on their own people. Now I have to ask you, what say you, Monsieur Yves Saint Laurent? Do you like the smell of Rwanda replacing spa?
You really can't make this stuff up. It's so shocking. I mean, don't get me wrong. Kigali is a beautiful little city. It's rolling hills. They have a nice nightlife. There's things happening. But yes, 40% of its people live in poverty. None of these people buy Schumacher or Montoya paraphernalia. These people are suffering, folks. And just because some guy in the Rwanda Auto Club has a few connections, who's going to build the infrastructure? It's completely out of their league. Yet, unfortunately, Domenicali, instead of sitting down and giving him the truth, strings them along like fly fishing. I think it's just, I am at a loss for words.
Well, how these things work in countries like that, as you said, who will build the infrastructure? Oh, it could be Prime Minister's brother-in-law who will start a company after giving up his job in some other industry. And that's how these things happen. Look what happened in China. The guy who brought the Grand Prix, he went to jail. Same thing happened in Vietnam. And I think a similar case is going on in Singapore also against the guy who was involved in the bringing the Grand Prix there. But to do this kind of stuff in these countries is just very, very shameful. So you and I are at least in agreement on this issue, if not on Alonso.
Absolutely. This is just over the top. And let's think about the poor people. Why don't we do this? Let's get rid of a Grand Prix and give $30 million to the poor people of Kigali.
Yeah, exactly. Okay, sir, so now we're going to move on. And now we present our Rod Stewart segment. First Kurt is the deepest. Today we look at first Grand Prix winner from each nation. The first Grand Prix, which was held at Silverstone in 1950, it was won by a paisan from Italy, Nino Farina. He went on to become Formula One's first world champion at the season finale in Parco Monza. The second nation to have success in Formula One was Argentina, when the maestro Juan Manuel Fangio took his first Grand Prix victory in the streets of Monte Carlo, which was round two of the 1950 championship. Interestingly, it was not until the 1953 French Grand Prix that we had a Grand Prix winner who was not from Italy or Argentina. Now keep in mind, I am not including the Indy 500 winners because we're talking about Grand Prix winners. The 1953 French Grand Prix took place at the Reims Street Circuit, and after a long race battle, Mike Hawthorn from jolly old England in a Ferrari won the race over Fangio in his Alfa Romeo. York, Shangri-La, France was the next nation to have a winner when Maurice Trintignant won the 1955 Monaco Grand Prix in a Ferrari. You know, in his career, he won only two Formula One races, and both of them were in Monaco. 1959 was a very good year for three drivers who took their first Grand Prix wins. The season opener in Monte Carlo, the race was won by Jack Brabham, and by doing so, he became the first Australian Grand Prix winner. And he was driving this beautiful little rear-engine Cooper Climax, and he would go on to win the first of his three championships at the end of the 1959 season. Joe Bonnier in a BRM became the first Swedish winner at Zandvoort, and this turned out to be his one and only victory. Third man to score his first Grand Prix victory in 1959 also became the youngest winner at that time. And this was at a track 90 minutes from where I am, Tampa FLA, at a place called Sebring. The winner was Bruce McLaren in a Cooper. McLaren's record of youngest race winner will stand till the 2003 Hungarian Grand Prix. I can't seem to find the face of this new youngest winner in my mind. So, Mr. Rogers, who could that be? Please help me make it through the podcast.
Oh, it's really simple. It's the most talented driver that's on the grid today from Spain, and his name is not Carlos.
Oh, it's the machismo, Fernando Alonso, of course. 1960 Parco Monza was a historical race, a case of first and last Grand Prix win. It was the first Grand Prix win for an American driver, and that was Phil Hill from Sheryl Crow's favorite city, When the Sun Comes Up on Santa Monica Boulevard. And have you ever been to Santa Monica, sir?
Of course.
You like the town?
It's very sweet and loving right there next to Huntington Beach. Beautiful little houses built in the 30s. Nice little community.
Yeah, at one time it was a big aircraft manufacturing hub. It was we're talking the 1960 Italian Grand Prix. It was the final Formula One success for a car with an engine in front, in this case a red-hot Ferrari from Maranello. 1961 at Zandvoort, it was Deutschland and Wolfgang von Trips über alles. Von Trips, whose nickname was Taffy, also won the British Grand Prix that season at Aintree and was sadly killed along with many spectators at Monza after colliding with Jim Clark's Lotus. The final race of the 1961 season was the first ever Grand Prix at Watkins Glen, which after seeing with my own eyes is a very beautiful track in a very beautiful part of the Empire State. And with that, a little shout out and big thanks again to Signor Pasquale for his wonderful guided tour. The race saw first ever win for Lotus and the first ever win for a driver from Scotland. Surprisingly, it was not Jim Clark, but Innes Ireland. Few weeks after winning this race, Ireland was let go from Lotus by Colin Chapman, and Ireland remained very bitter all his life towards Clark, claiming that it was him who pushed him out of the team. Later, Ireland wrote Grand Prix reports for Road and Track magazine, which I used to enjoy a lot back in the day. So, did you ever read Road and Track magazine when you were growing up?
Of course, sir. Everybody did. I even had a subscription for years and years and years. It took me years just to get rid of them all. So, yes, Road and Track was great. You can get all the stats, the updates on the Formula One races, because in the old days, there wasn't any Formula One on television.
Yeah, and speaking of Road and Track, Rob Walker, whose car in his Ireland was driving when he won the US Grand Prix, he also wrote Grand Prix stories for them. The opening round of the 1967 season in South Africa saw first ever Grand Prix winner from south of the border down Mexico Way. Pedro Rodriguez was the winner in a Maserati-powered Cooper. So unexpected was this victory that the organizers did not even have recording of Mexican national anthem, so they played Mexican Hat Dance. And you know, I remember this English kid, Jake Dennis, who I think is now in Formula E. When he was in, I think it was in Formula 3, he won a race. And he's from England and they played the French national anthem. So these things do happen now and then. Okay, Belgium was on the schedule in the inaugural season of Formula 1 in 1950 at the much-loved, of course, Spa-Francorchamps. But the nation of Stella Artois and Sprouts had to wait till the 1968 French Grand Prix in the rain at Rouen to have its first winner, and that was Jackie Ickx in a Ferrari. This was the race in which Joe Schlesser was killed in his air-cooled Honda, which John Surtees had refused to drive because it had a lot of magnesium parts in it. He thought it was unsafe. And you know, interestingly, when Jackie Ickx left Maranello on Ferrari, Enzo's last words to him, "We must only remember the good times," which is a lot more comforting than what Enzo Ferrari told Chris Amon when he was leasing. And he said to him, "I will win a race before you do." Wow, very haunting words. Okay, so now we come to Watkins Glen 1969. Jochen Rindt became the first Austrian winner in Formula One driving a Lotus. Jochen was born in Germany. His parents were killed in a bombing raid on Hamburg during the Second World War. He was brought up by his grandparents in Graz, Austria. They were involved in spice trade. In school, he met Helmut Marko, who went on to become Doctor of Jurisprudence and highly efficient in prescribing, "Your services are no longer required," to many young drivers. You know, when I was talking to, I did not say this to him, when I was talking to him, he was talking about some of the drivers that were let go. And he said, "This is not acceptable to us. And if you do a Dr. Marko and Jaime Algrosari search on YouTube, you can see a situation where in front of the, you know, their pits, poor Jaime is trying to explain what happened. And Dr. Marko is just staring at him. And then after Jaime makes his second attempt to explain, Dr. Marko says, "We don't accept." I'm glad he accepted me for an interview, so my feeling donkey to him. Okay, sir, moving on. Parco Monza, 1970. Swiss timing rings first ever win for Clara Gazzoni, and only his, I think it was his fourth or fifth Formula One start for Ferrari. Now, this was on the weekend Jochen Rindt was killed on Saturday. 9 years later, in 1979, at Silverstone, Regazzoni gave Frank Williams his first Grand Prix win. And Frank, for years and years till he passed away, had a painting of that in his office. The season 1970 would also see the first ever win for a Brazilian driver when Emerson Fittipaldi took victory at Watkins Glen in what was his fifth ever start. I think it was like Regazzoni, he won very quickly, driving for Colin Chapman. Jody Scheckter from South Africa takes his maiden win at the 1974 Swedish Grand Prix at Anderstorp, driving for Ken Tyrrell. 2 years later, at the same track located in the Swedish boonies, and I've been to this track, Scheckter gave the Tyrrell six-wheeler its only Grand Prix victory, and quite a day that was. 1978, towards the end of the season in Montreal, local yokel Gilles Villeneuve wins his first race in the beautiful Ferrari 312 T3. His son Jack never won his home Grand Prix, but did become and remain so far the only Canadian Formula One world champion. And sir, as I've said many times before, Gilles is one of the very few Formula One drivers like Ronnie Peterson and Gerhard Berger who were well-liked by everyone. Enzo Ferrari went so far to say Gilles reminded him of Tazio Nuvolari. Now that compliment is on the same level as Enzo saying to Mario Andretti, "I have no price for your talents." And with that, we come to our eternal favorite, Dijon-Prenois. This track hosted the 1982 Swiss Grand Prix. For the first time, we had driver from Finlandia on the top step of the podium, Mr. Keke Rosberg, who was born in Stockholm, Sweden, driving for Team Willy. And from here, it just gets better. Percolated Colombian Juan Pablo Montoya took an impressive maiden win at Monza in 2001, driving the BMW-powered Williams. Robert Kubica, the Bobby Vinton of motorsports, in other words, Polish Prince, became the first and only Grand Prix winner from his country by taking victory in Montreal in 2008, driving the BMW Sauber car, and this came after surviving a horrific crash at the same track the previous year. All rise now, May 13, 2012, a day that will live in motorsports infamy. Man from Maracaibo, Venezuela, beats hombre from Oviedo, España, take his monumental and very historical first Grand Prix win in Barcelona. The image of Maldonado being hoisted by Alonso and Raikkonen is one of the most beautiful motorsports memories for me. Even the president of Venezuela at that time, Senor Hugo Chavez, proudly said, our Pasteur has won a Grand Prix, and this is quite an achievement for any nation. How did Pasteur perform in front of his home crowd in a demo run? He crashed on the first corner of the temporary track. The one-time winner Pasteur was crushado other times, and Williams has not won a Grand Prix since that day. And now we come to 2019. Louis Chiron was a very famous Grand Prix driver from Monaco. After his driving days were over, he was the official starter of the Monaco Grand Prix for years and years. And sir, do you remember this book that this English guy, Louis T. Stanley, used to put out, Grand Prix 65, Grand Prix 66? Do you remember those books?
Yes, I have a few of those books.
Yeah, I used to read them again and again at the British Council Library in downtown Karachi back in the day. And I saw a lot of his pictures. In those days, guys would be standing in the middle of the track to start the race and also to basically do the checkered flag. But he never won a Grand Prix, and that honor went to his hombre, Monsieur Charles Leclerc. His victory in Spa came in 2009 on board a Ferrari. And next year, he will have a new teammate, LCH. And I have a feeling their 2025 season will be gunfight at the OK Corral, not in Tombstone, Arizona, or near Tombstone, Arizona, but in Maranello, Italia. Are you looking forward to that, sir?
Yeah, I am. The only problem is they'll be more concerned with the underperforming Ferrari while the McLarens and the Mercedes are out front conquering the world.
At Ferrari next year, there will be one survival, and time will tell who will be Gloria Gaynor of Maranello. Okay, sir, we have a lot of information here. We've been talking about international races and drivers from this country and that country. I think it's time to invite Miss Rafaela Elgar for her segment on part two of Boys from Brazil. Shall we do that now?
Please.
Here's Rafa.
Hello, listeners. Rafaela here. I am back with part two of Grand Prix Drivers from Brazil. Like part one, drivers in today's report raced in Formula One for many years, but unfortunately were unable to achieve the ultimate goal, the Formula One World Championship. Let's start with Pedro Diniz. He's from São Paulo and took part in 98 Formula One races. His career is typical of modern-day motor racer, powered more by pesos than performance. Diniz was a late start in racing, beginning in karting at the age of 18. After competing in Brazilian Formula Ford and South American Formula 3, he arrived in England to take part in the 1991 British Formula 3 Championship with West Surrey Racing, the same team that had taken his fellow Paulista with the yellow helmet to championship success in 1983. He finished 12th at the end of the season and moved to Edenbridge Racing Team for the 1992 season. He again finished 12th in the standings and remained winningless after 2 years in the British Formula 3. 2 years in Formula 3000 also did not produce any race wins. With family funding, Diniz arrived in Formula 1 in 1995 with the small Italian team Forti Corsi. He did not score any points and his best finish was 7th in the season finale in Australia, 4 laps behind race winner Damon Hill. Change of teams from Forti to Ligier produced 2 points in the 1996 championship from 6th-place finishes in Barcelona and Monza. Third season in Formula 1 saw Diniz at Tom Walkinshaw run Arrows team in 1997. He retired in the first 10 of the 13 races of the season. The 2 points he scored came from 5th-place in the Luxembourg Grand Prix. In 1998, he finished 14th in the championship with 3 points. His final 2 years in Formula 1, 1999 and 2000, were with Sauber team. In 1999, he again finished 14th in the championship with 3 points, and he did not score any points in his final Formula 1 season. Next, we look at the racing life of Mauricio Gujanwin. He came from Joinville in the state of Santa Catarina. His father was a timber merchant like Jackie Stewart's team owner Ken Tyrrell. After winning karting and Formula Fiat championships in Brazil, Mauricio moved to England in 1982. He shared an apartment with Senna. His championship success included the 1982 British Formula Ford 1600 and the 1984 European Formula Ford and the 1985 British Formula 3. He also won the prestigious Macau Grand Prix from pole position and also set the fastest lap. He made his Grand Prix debut in home race in Rio in 1988. In 74 Formula One races, his best finish was third place in 1989 at the same track. The same year, he was involved in a spectacular crash at the start of the French Grand Prix at Paul Ricard. He would restart the red flag race and amazingly set the fastest lap. In life after Formula One, Gu Xiaoming raced in the United States. He was sixth in the 1995 Indy 500 and won the 1997 Vancouver IndyCar race. He retired from racing at the end of 2001 season following the death of his young son, Giuliano. Next, the superb sub, Roberto Moreno. His nickname is Pupu. He's from Brasilia, capital city of Brazil. As a young boy, he went to a local motorbike shop and met a teenager who was working there. His name was Nelson Piquet. The two became and remain to this day good friends. Sadly, both share a common dislike of Senna. Moreno from his karting days and Piquet from his F1 days. His claim to fame before reaching Formula One including winning the 1980 British Formula Ford Championship and the famous Formula Ford Festival at Brands Hatch, the 1982 Macau Grand Prix, and the 1988 Formula 3000 Championship. He made his Formula One debut in the 1987 Japanese Grand Prix. In 42 Formula One races, Moreno's day of days came in 1990 Japanese Grand Prix at Suzuka when he shared a podium in second place with his race-winning Benetton teammate and friend Piquet. This was his only podium in Formula One and his only fastest was recorded at Spa in 1991. In 7 years in Formula One, he drove for 9 teams. Pupu was pushed out of Benetton by Briatore to bring in Michael Schumacher. In life after Formula One, Moreno had a winning career in American Indy car racing. Next, a famous racing family name, Fittipaldi. Christian Fittipaldi was the son of Wilson and nephew of the first Brazilian world champion, Emerson Fittipaldi. Christian made his Formula One debut in the 1992 South African Grand Prix at Kyalami with Minardi. In 40 F1 appearances, his best finish was fourth to three occasions. 1993 South Africa, 1994 Pacific GP at Aida, Japan, and Germany. His most dramatic moment in Formula One came on the final lap at Monza in 1993 on the run to the checkered flag. His Minardi was launched in the air at very high speed after running into the back of his teammate's Pierluigi Martini's car. Fortunately, Fittipaldi's car landed on the wheels, crossed the finish line. The driver was unhurt. In IndyCar racing, Fittipaldi had two wins, at Road America, Wisconsin in 1999 and the 2000 Marlboro 500 at Fontana, California. He also enjoyed a successful sports car career in the United States, winning the famous Daytona 24-hour race 3 times. Felipe Nasser. An amazing rise in Junior Series, which saw the teenage boy from Brasilia of Lebanese heritage win 2 championships in his first 3 years of racing in Europe. He only did 2 races in Brazil in the South American Formula BMW Series. These were support races at the famous 2008 season finale in São Paulo. In 2009, Felipe raced in the European Formula BMW Championship and destroyed the competition. It was around this time that he signed a management contract with Steven Robertson. His only other client was Kimi Raikkonen. In 2011, Felipe won the British Formula 3 after a strong challenge in the second half from Kevin Magnussen. Hopes were very high to become a junior driver with a top team, but 3 years in GP2 with no championship derailed that dream. With sponsorship from Banco do Brasil, he secured a seat at Sauber. Felipe made headlines around the world when he scored the best ever finish on debut for a Brazilian driver in Formula 1 history. He did 39 races in his 2 years at Sauber. In life after Formula One, he has enjoyed a successful career in sports car racing. In January of this year, he won the Daytona 24-hour race as a factory Porsche driver with Penske Racing. Next, Nelson Piquet Jr. Like Nico Rosberg, a child of world champion driver, both went to the same school in Monaco. Nelson was Brazilian Formula 3 champion and raced in GP2 for his father's team. He was impressive in his second season of GP2, but had to face Lewis Hamilton in 2006, who won the championship. Nelson was managed by Briatore, which meant a free ride to Renault Formula One team, also managed by Briatore. This would turn out to be very costly. Nelsinho took part in 28 Formula One races. His best performance was in the 2008 European Grand Prix. Spilling the beans on Briatore made Nelsinho a pariah in the piranha pool that is Formula One. He crossed the pond and joined the murky waters of NASCAR Nation. Other honorable names are Ricardo Rosset, Tarso Marquez, Raul Boesio, and Luciano Burti. But this is a conversation for another time. Thank you so much for listening.
Okay, Nas, keep up the good work. Thank you, Rafa. We'll be back after the Walter Cronkite Corner.
The GPDA say Spa is out. At a GPDA meeting in Paris, President Joe Bonnier said that it was certain the Formula One Belgian Grand Prix would never again be held on the Spa-Francorchamps circuit. The race would probably be run at Zolder. As to the Nürburgring, the owners of the circuit had undertaken to make the 108 modifications requested by the GPDA in the course of the next 2 years. Joe Bonnier said the GPDA are often criticized for its interest in safety, but few people seem to understand it was concerning not only with the safety of the drivers, but also the safety of spectators, marshals, journalists, and photographers. Speaking of the resignation of Jackie Eakes from the GPDA, Joe Bonnier said that while it was to be regretted, most drivers were men of strong personality and could not be expected to agree with GPDA's policy all the time. In spite of its imperfections, the GPDA had succeeded in making the views of the drivers heard at a time when they were not being listened to. The Von Trips Memorial Trophy for the promising new Grand Prix driver was awarded to Clay Regazzoni, and the GPDA Organizers Trophy was awarded jointly to Germany for the Grand Prix at Hockenheim and to the USA for the Grand Prix at Watkins Glen. The RAC's British Grand Prix at Brands Hatch came bottom of the list, even below the Mexican Grand Prix. And that's the way it was. December 1970. Back to you, Nasser.
Hi, I'm Nick Heidfeld, and you're listening to F1 Weekly.
Welcome back to F1Weekly.com. Clark Rogers here, your host. And now, as we spin the globe and go around the world with Motorsports Mondial, with the king, the Sultan himself, Nasser Hamid.
Thank you, sir. Okay, sir, now we're going to go and talk to more people. And here is a conversation with Scott Mitchell, mom. He is now working with some people who are, Glenn Freeman is one of them, very good journalist, and so is Scott Mitchell. They are at an organization called therace.com. And I go to their website, and this gentleman is very knowledgeable. Ed Straw is the other one. And I've never met Glenn Freeman, but I enjoy his work very much. But I've met Ed Straw and Scott Mitchell. So here's a conversation with Scott Mitchell. Please enjoy this, and I would like to thank him for his time.
Folks, I'm here with Scott Mitchell, mom. Scott, I enjoy your work very much. Good to meet you. How are you today?
I'm good, thank you. It's always quite a spectacle when we come here for any of the American F1 races, but I think they all have something slightly different to offer, and I quite like the vibe. It's a bit too hot for me.
Three American races, which one is your favourite?
All round Austin. I do really, really like Austin, partly because I think it was the first American race I went to, so it was my first proper experience of like a US Grand Prix. I've got one of my best friends lives in Austin as well, so I have a bit of an emotional attachment because I get to see him. This is the only time of the year I get to see him. But I have to say, after the changes that they made to this race between years one and two, I enjoyed this event a lot more. And I was pleasantly surprised by Vegas last year. I was a bit worried about that race, but the sense of the spectacle and the location won me over, and the race was pretty good as well. So there. It's a good trio. It's a good trio of races, I think.
Yeah. Did you enjoy the $1,200 a night room rate?
No. There's I think they are among the most expensive. In the end, I think in Vegas we changed hotels, I think, like a week before the race, because it was so expensive, and then we just found somewhere that was actually, like, I think we saved hundreds of dollars by changing the week before, and we felt kind of bad, but at the same time we thought, don't charge that much money in the first place.
Lewis to Ferrari, almost everything leaks out in Ferrari. How did this come out from the left field, basically, for all of us?
Yeah, we were very surprised. I think it was around this time last year there was first some rumours about it, but those rumours kind of always exist, and there's always some talk about that kind of thing. Every time Lewis is out of contract, there's been a bit of, you know, could he go somewhere else? He's talked about wanting to go to, or liking the idea of racing for Ferrari. So from that side, not hugely surprising that it was a talking point. But I remember when it leaked, I will admit to thinking it was nonsense. I didn't think it was accurate. I assumed it was more sort of fanciful speculation. But that was because the crucial bit of missing information for everybody was that when Mercedes had announced him in, I think it was August last year, it was presented almost as a 2-year deal, but then obviously we subsequently found out it was a 1+1, and Lewis had the opportunity to depart, which is why I think if we'd all known that, maybe we'd have taken it a little bit more seriously at the time. But yeah, the way it leaked out over that kind of the few hours in the 24 hours or so before it was official was among the most crazy few hours I can remember. It was just like things were flying everywhere, and trying to stay on top of it was it was a challenge, but it was fun.
I think he still has the talent, but do you think at his age he has the fight to get championship number 8?
I think so. I think there's the problem is that over the last sort of 2 and a bit years now, he's only so often had a car capable of fighting for a pole position every now and again, or a front row of the grid, but obviously not really fought for wins. He has had chances to score podiums, and he's taken those chances, but there was one instance recently that made me pretty confident that desire and motivation and fight is still there, and it was the start of the sprint race in China, when Lewis got a great launch, attacked Norris into turn one, and he didn't force Lando off the track or anything like that, but the way that he attacked that first corner and wanted to take the lead in a sprint race, which I don't really think any of the drivers, they don't care about that to the same extent as they do a Grand Prix, but it was very clear in that moment Lewis saw a chance to lead a race and potentially win a race, even if it was only a sprint, and he went for it. If that desire and fight is there in that circumstance, then if he has a car that is capable of fighting for wins in a championship, I think he's going to give it absolutely 100%. I think he's still so committed to being a Formula 1 driver and a top Formula 1 driver that for me the motivation's not in question. We obviously will only get a full answer of that if Ferrari give him a car that's actually capable of doing the job.
What keeps my faith in him for Championship 8 or even 9 is the last 4 races of the 2021 season. That was unbelievable.
Yeah, he was... So I don't think it's difficult to phrase this correctly, because sometimes it can make it sound like you think Lewis isn't at 100% all the time. But there are moments in races where the body language of Lewis's car changes, where he goes to another sort of level. So it's not about effort or how much he's trying, it's just kind of what he unlocks from himself and what he's capable of doing when the car and the situation demands it and allows him to perform at that level. And that run at the end of 2021 is, in the time that I've been covering Formula 1 full time, which isn't a particularly impressive time span, but over the last 5 or 6 years I've watched Lewis win lots of races and championships, and that late spell in 2021 was the best I've ever seen him drive. So if he can tap into anything close to that, I see no reason why he couldn't fight for a championship if he had the car.
Yeah, totally agree. Adrian Newey to somewhere, how much of his decision you think is based on the ongoing Christian Horner situation?
If you listen to Red Bull or Christian Horner, nothing. But I don't buy that. I think the fact that Adrian gave a short interview, I think, to Sky Sports F1 over the course of this weekend, and there was a very telling moment where he drifted ever so slightly off of kind of the message that has been very clear from Red Bull since it was announced. And he talked about, you know, he mentioned in it that he's tired, a little bit tired. He talked about wanting to take some time off and travel and have a bit of a break, that he has no plans set. But he did say that he's had these feelings before, and as events unfolded this year, it came to the fore again. He has effectively admitted that the circumstances of this season have played a part in his decision. So only he knows, truthfully, how much of a factor it was, but it was definitely a factor. There's no doubt in my mind that there were some genuine underlying tensions already, whether that was about Red Bull politics or his the amount of praise and credit that he gets for the performance and the success of recent years. But as this year evolved, I think Zak Brown said he knew he's a man of integrity, and Zak was obviously very clearly pushing a message that it was that drove Nui out. I wouldn't want to say that was the number one reason or it was 90% of the rationale, but it was very, very clearly a factor. He wasn't happy there, and that was something that helped him realise that he wanted to leave and actually go ahead with, because it's all well and good, it's one thing to want to leave, but it's a big step to then actually do it. So something clearly changed for him to actually go through with it.
No, I'm not trying to be a conspiracy theorist here, but no gardening leave for Adrian, which is a good move by his lawyers. But is there more to the story, like he knows something that Christian and Red Bull does not want to come out?
There's whenever there's any kind of negotiation like this, the strength of your hand obviously depends on how much leverage you have. So there'll be something. There will obviously be something. I think with the way that they've framed it, I think Adrian is going to have almost a year of gardening leave. But it starts effectively now. He's here this weekend. I think there will be probably other races that he turns up at in team gear, and he's finishing the RB17 hypercar project too. So there will be a bit of Red Bull work still to do. But I think he will then be on the sidelines very, very quickly, and then that will be his gardening leave until the first couple of months of next year. So to have secured that when the original contract and the original terms and clauses that existed could have kept him basically hostage at Red Bull until the end of 2026, to have got out of that, and I think a lot of us were genuinely surprised to discover that Eddie Jordan played a key part in that. He's Adrian's close friend and manager, as it turns out, which genuinely I think like hardly anyone seemed to know, and I definitely didn't. They've played that very well, and then there will be something. It could be as straightforward as with the stuff that is going on at Red Bull and with Christian. The simplest scenario is to let Adrian go, because it would not be beneficial for them to have concurrent legal negotiations and battles, and you wouldn't want anything to come out from the Horner Red Bull Adrian situation that could potentially negatively impact anything else.
I think EJ loves a good cut. Okay, with Adrian Newey and Honda gone from Red Bull by the end of 2025, do you think the 2026 Red Bull car will be Max's W13?
I think the potential for that exists, and I think that is the reason why there is just this constant narrative that he could leave before then. That exists for a reason. I don't think Max is driving it. I think it's a thing that his father Jos is pushing quite hard for. I think if Jos had his way, Max would leave Red Bull and join Mercedes next season in 2025, ahead of 2026, because Jos, I think, believes that the Mercedes bet for 26 is better than the Red Bull bet. And I think ultimately the strength of the Red Bull car in 26 will depend on whether you believe Adrian was key to it, or whether it is the wider technical group led by Pierre Vacher. The engine is the thing that I have the bigger question mark over, because the process of building a Formula One engine is enormously complex, and you have seen in this V6 turbo hybrid era that established successful engine manufacturers have screwed it up and got it wrong. Red Bull's doing it for the first time. Now they are recruiting very, very skilled, intelligent, experienced people to lead that project and be part of it, and there is meant to be some forward input of some kind. But the V6 engine is one thing, the energy recovery system and the MGUK and the battery is a whole other level of challenge, and You only have to look at how much Renault and Honda struggled, and Ferrari in the first year or two as well, to maximise that. I think that could be what tripped Rebel up. So I think there's every possibility that the car could be quite good in 26, but the engine could be a missing link potentially.
I think we're going to have a 2026 Ford GP2 engine, but that's just my take on it. Okay, what is your take on Formula One's rejection of Andretti Global's entry despite being approved by FIA? To me, it screams GREED, all in big, bold, capital letters. What say you?
Money is obviously the key factor, which to me is only valid if there is genuinely nothing credible about the team that wants to come in. I sincerely believe that the commercial rights holder is correct to protect the existing 10 teams against weakening the grid by letting in a team that wouldn't add anything, would be uncompetitive and wouldn't take it seriously. But the more that comes out from Andretti and General Motors, the more I believe that that's not them. They're clearly serious about it. They are putting in place a lot of things that are good. I'm not convinced by all of it. I think, and this isn't because I don't think you can run a team out of the US or anything like that, and I don't believe there's any reason to think that if it's staffed by people in the US rather than people in Europe, it will be worse, because I have no evidence to believe that, for whatever reason, Europeans can run an F1 team better than Americans. It's not about that. It's just that what's the best word to use? The complications of trying to get people that have existing F1 knowledge, most of that knowledge base is in Europe just because of where all the other teams are, trying to get those people to live and work in America, especially ones that have families, can be really tricky. And we see that on a smaller scale with teams in the Italian teams, and you know what Audi's doing at Sauber with a team based in Switzerland. Trying to get people from the UK, for example, to go there is difficult enough. Trying to get people to trade that for the US, which is so far away from what they know, which can have complications from an employment perspective and a complete change of life, especially if you have a family again, that's really difficult. So I like that they're putting together this UK base. I think that it depends how big a part of it the UK base becomes. I think it has to be taken seriously, and probably more seriously than it's being given credit for. The one thing I'm concerned about with what F1 has done is some of the arguments that they've laid out don't really make sense, and I would quite like to have a clearer idea of how that has changed, because some stuff just doesn't stack up. And I've got a bit of a fear that it kind of doesn't matter what Andretti and General Motors put forward. I think they'll just get the commercial rights holder will find a reason to justify rejecting them. And I do worry that there's nothing Andretti and General Motors can do to make F1 say yes.
Well, I think in that case, the Formula One people need to be introduced to an entity here called the U.S. Congress. They are now looking into this on antitrust ground, and sadly for Liberty Media, they are U.S.-based, so they will come under these regulations. Do you think the wrath of U.S. federal government will come down on Formula One soon?
Tricky to say. When a few of the team bosses were asked about this, they've taken the kind of easy way out and said they don't really, they're not experts in the US system, so they can't comment. And I would say it's a little bit similar for me in that I don't know to what extent that influence can reach. The one thing I would say with it is that if Andretti and GM have certain people on side and have political weight behind them, that is going to help their case in terms of applying as much pressure on F1 and Liberty from as many different directions as possible, because that is ultimately, I think, their only tactic now. I have felt at times like they have been unnecessarily antagonistic, and that maybe there would have been a little bit more room for diplomacy at different stages. You know, it was this race a couple of years ago where Michael was going around trying to get teams to sign a petition to let them go in, let them enter, which just completely flew in the face of the process that exists. I believe that if processes exist, you should follow them, and they should be done properly. Where that obviously falls down is if the process is manipulated in any way, which is what clearly some people think is happening with this. Andretti has gone through the process, the FAA has said yes, and F1's coming up with excuses to say no. So now I feel like Andretti believes we don't have a choice, that we've done everything right, and they're still saying no. So now we need to find other reasons to kind of hammer the door down. Some political support could be quite important to making that happen.
And you know, I was talking to Mario yesterday. He said he wanted to clarify that him and Mike did not approach the U.S. Congress. Mm. They approached, asked him to come and explain what's going on here. But you know, the legal system in the U.S. is beautiful. We have more lawyers than 7-Eleven. So it should be a fun fight. Now, I want to ask you a question I once asked many years ago from Matt Bishop. You have, I'm sure, interviewed a lot of drivers, right? Mm-hmm. So if you can share with us, and no PC required here, who are the good guys and who are the buttheads when you interview them?
Okay, I think the best interview, the most enjoyable interview I ever did was a couple of years ago in Singapore. I interviewed Daniel Ricciardo about the struggles he was having at McLaren, and I didn't enjoy it because Daniel was struggling and all of that. That obviously sucks. But the reason I enjoyed it is because when Daniel's the kind of person who, if you have a decent relationship with him, you know, I would never pretend to be friends with any of the drivers, but I've got a decent relationship with Ricciardo. I think he knows that I don't go out to, you know, stitch drivers up or anything like that. And but by that point, I had written quite a lot in 22 about his struggles and the fact that he could lose his drive and stuff like this. So if he wanted to have a problem with me, he could have used that to have a problem with me. But I think we were scheduled to have like a 15-minute interview, and we spoke for about 35 minutes. He went into incredibly open detail about like the extent of his struggles, what he was dealing with, and how he was trying to work through it, rationalising lots of stuff in the moment, going existential in terms of his F1 career and looking at it. He's amazing. I really enjoy having conversations with him on and off the record. Actually, to be fair, like a lot of the drivers aren't all good. Even ones that I think have a slightly negative reputation, like sometimes I know I've got people back home in the UK and in Sweden who really don't like Max because they just don't like the way he comes across. They think he's smug, arrogant or whatever. I've never had a bad conversation with Max, and I've had quite a few chances to interview him over the years one-to-one, and we've traded stories about karting and what our respective racing dads were like back in the day and stuff like this. So I quite like that. The ones that are difficult are the ones that I think have their guard up, for sometimes for understandable reasons, sometimes not. So I think even the worst ones that I've dealt with, I've still had good conversations with them. You've still had moments where the guard drops. Like Lance Stroll, for example, is someone I think a lot of people have as one of the more difficult people to interview. I would kind of describe him in that way sometimes. We have moments after qualifying in the race where you go and speak to him and he doesn't want to say more than two words. And it can be really, really frustrating. But at the same time, I've still had 15-minute, 20-minute conversations with him before where he's really impassioned talking about things like safety and karting and stuff like that, where you wouldn't think necessarily that this guy cares about this kind of stuff. So I don't think there's anyone on the grid who is I think is a real arse or anyone like properly low, like I never want to speak to this guy again. But there are a couple that are more difficult, let's put it that way.
Well, we're going to bring one name that may be in that category. According to Matt Bishop, the biggest butthead was, is, and ever will be, is Eddie Irvine. Have you ever interviewed him?
I haven't, but I've heard stories along those lines, and I can absolutely imagine that those interviews or attempted interviews would go down the line of Eddie thinking he was absolutely in the right and the person interviewing him is absolutely in the wrong. And that's, yeah, I wouldn't be able to get very far with that kind of conversation. I think I'd struggle.
That will be a first, right?
Yeah, exactly. Like I say, even the ones that are really difficult now, it's not that bad, I don't think. But Eddie was from a different time in F1 and has a particular reputation. So, yeah, I'm not surprised.
You know, he's based here and doing very well in real estate business.
I know he did very well for himself. He turned his earnings from F1 into just more and more money constantly. So maybe he's right to be arrogant. Like, he clearly knows something we don't.
So if you want to buy $1 million beach house, call Eddie.
I think I might need to just ask for a little bit of a raise to be able to afford something like that.
Okay, thank you so much.
Scott, thanks for joining F1Weekly.com. Nas, let's wrap it up.
Okay, Mr. Rogers, Le Host, before we go to famous last words, any thoughts you have? How much are you suffering for the no Formula One?
Well, I'm getting ready to go to Europe. It's a lot of technical stuff. And it's going to be interesting when we go to Zandvoort, Orange Country, with a lackadaisical Red Bull in front of his people. I think he's going to take it on the chin, try to be humorous, crack some jokes, while Lewis Hamilton goes on and wins the big bag of black licorice.
Yes, sir. I am been watching a lot of motorsports of all types. I've been watching a lot of MotoGP races, documentaries. There are a lot of documentaries, you know, in French language and German and French on people like Kenny Roberts, Giacomo Agostini, and Barry Shane. And some of them have English subtitles, so I'm enjoying that very much. But what I'm really enjoying, even if I don't understand the language, is when they are showing races from Isle of Man, Salzburg Ring, Imatra in Finland. And, you know, they used to have Grand Prix MotoGP motorcycle races in Yugoslavia, in East Germany. So I'm really enjoying this. And today, before recording began, I was watching the 1984 German Grand Prix. Your man, Alain Prost, was leading and pretty much had the race won. But then Dunn blowed up, so he did not win. So I'm making the most I can of no motor racing by racing from days gone by on 2 and 4 wheels. Okay, sir, now we come to famous last words. Today they come from a gentleman who carried the F1 baton from Bernie to Liberty Media. Please note this conversation took place in open air, so the sound does not have the quality of EMI Studios. Here's Mr. Chase Carey. Thank you for listening. See you in a destination city. Ta-ta.
Thank you and good night.
Mr. Carey. Hi.
How are you?
Sir, my name is Nasser. May I ask you a couple of questions, please?
Sure.
You guys have done a tremendous job in popularizing Formula One.
Stefano and his team are leading it, so I've handed off the keys, so I'm not cheerleader now. So.
But are you still involved with it?
Not in any formal way.
Oh,
so
really?
I finished up as chairman a year ago.
But you were there when they did the Netflix, right?
Yeah.
Was that your brainchild or Mr. Bratches?
No, I mean, it was all of us. I mean, there's no one brainchild. You sort of all have a, you know, you work together to create something that you think can benefit, you know, benefit what you're trying to do.
It's unbelievable what it has done. I was at the Austin race a few years ago as a spectator, which is what I am, a fan, and it took me more than 4 hours to get out of the area. So I'm so very happy in 3 races here. Do you think we're going to see more in the U.S.?
I think 3, probably for the short term, is, you know, probably, you know, as much, you know, the right number, but just look, you always, there's interest probably. There are other places we could go. I mean, I think you got to trade it off against other places. But right now, Formula One's in a fortunate place where they got more people who want to race than, you know, I think 24 is probably as many as we're going to have. So it's obviously complicated to fit. You know, I mean, anytime you want to add one, somebody's got to fall away. So.
Well, I hope you don't cut Monza and Spa.
No, you can't cut it. No, look, I mean, I think we've always been clear that, you know, the sport's the base, the historic base of the sport, and sports are based on history, and, you know, Western Europe is the foundation of it, and, you know, there are places that have anchored sport from its get-go. So, I think those Western European locations are the foundation.
There was some reports, quite a few reports, that there's a trademark for the Chicago Grand Prix. So, any chance of a Formula One in Windy City?
Yeah, I'm not going to. I mean, I'm not close enough to really be the one to comment on it. So, like I said, I'm not involved. I mean, I think probably those sort of things you do to have optionality, not, you know, they're not necessarily part of plans.
Okay. And you're still
at
Liberty Media, or
I have an advising role with Liberty Media.
Okay. Thank you so much.
All right.